Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with SportingBet.com.
Football Weekly, Man United Arsenal at Old Trafford. Wenger claims the high ground after being sent up to the stands and speaks out on anti-football. They have rubbish keepers apparently and should be making tea for uncles. Elsewhere, there's all the rest of the Premier League news too. Spurs, City, Pompey, there's the Liga, Real's opener and Ronaldo's tears with Sid Lowe. Italy, Inter tear Milan apart with more 1-2s than a roadie at a soundcheck. There's your post and Muto with the most expensive line of coke in history. All of that in today's Football Week. Hello there, everybody. Bank holiday down on planet Earth. But here in near-Earth orbit, the words day off, like gravity and adequate sanitation, really don't exist. And thus, Barry Glendenning is here, floating alongside me. Hi, Barry.
Hello.
Hi. Patient Barry today.
I'm very patient.
You are a patient man. Hey, it's Barney Roney.
Hello.
Hi, Barney. Back in the world of football after a summer of fun with cricket and rugby and other fun.
Yeah, I've been quite diverse this summer, but I'm fully back.
Immersed in the vitriol is how you described it, I think, earlier today.
Yeah, but I was just talking about Barry.
Oh, right, okay. And Paolo Bandini, special pod-long appearance today.
Hello.
Good to have you on board, Paolo. Benvenuto, as they say. Big story from the Premier League this weekend, arguably the clash at Old Trafford, Man United against Arsenal. I suppose we must start by asking Barney, was it a penalty?
Well, it was a penalty, albeit with a hint of dive added to it. I mean, I think you have to appreciate that these things look very different in super slow motion to how it actually happened at full speed with Rooney, who is aware of where the goalkeeper is in relation to him, sprinting straight at him, knows there's going to be contact, and he's expecting it as it happens, but it doesn't change the fact that it was a foul and a penalty. I think a lot of the sense of injustice comes from the fact that Arsenal were totally bossing the game at the time, and in terms of balance of play, it was very unfair. Mm. But, you know, it was a penalty.
Right.
On our blogs, a lot of readers have been posting comments to the effect, and they were all Arsenal fans, obviously, posting comments to the effect that it wasn't a penalty, and they're wrong. It's this fan thing of not being aware of the rules of football, but then just making some up to suit whatever argument it is you want to make. It was quite clearly a foul. There was contact between Almunia and Rooney, and it was a very ill-advised rush off the line because there was no need to do it. Rooney wasn't going to score. There was no real danger. The difference between that, say, and Boric's incident with Eduardo during the week was that Boric didn't put his hands out and did not touch Eduardo.
I think the thing that fans are getting onto here, and I think you're absolutely right, it certainly was a penalty at the weekend, it certainly wasn't with Eduardo, but I think what fans are getting at is the fact that Rooney was going down before the contact was made.
Yeah, but that doesn't make him a cheat. He knew he was about to be fouled. And what are you supposed to do? Stand there and take it in the face like a man? There was a tiny split second where it's obvious to the players around him, obvious to the goalie and obvious to Rooney that he is about to be fouled. They're professional footballers. This happens to them all the time. Everyone knows that Almunia has made a mistake. What are you supposed to do?
I actually absolutely agree with you, but what I mean is I think that Eduardo thought the same thing was going to happen, and he did the same thing.
Well, he made a mistake then, didn't he?
The only thing is that he judged it wrong and Rooney judged it right.
Right.
I did see somebody say that Rooney would have had time to hurdle Almunia and therefore not win a penalty. And they seem to be arguing that this is what he should have done.
No, that's not true. That comes from watching too much football on television where things are slowed down and there's no way he could have hurdled the goalkeeper. He was in his way.
The bigger issue, perhaps, aside from the fact that United did get the 3 points, is that this penalty and the extraordinary own goal by Diaby masked the fact that they were actually a bit rubbish. And on this kind of showing, Paul Doyle's famous assertion that they'll be dropping out of the Big Four isn't quite the stuff of madman's dreams the way that it sounded at the time.
It was definitely a worrying game for United, despite the fact that they won it. I thought the midfield looked very weak.
Name those midfield players.
Valencia, Nani, are they a couple of Champions League winning wingers?
I wouldn't think so. Valencia got hauled off after an hour, didn't he? And he played very poorly. Nani, I just don't rate him particularly. And if he doesn't blossom soon, I'd say he's going to get his cards and be shipped out.
Carrick got at the start. There was some talk that Carrick's absence had been one of the problems for United. Did he make much difference?
Carrick's a good central midfielder, but you know, you've got... But also, Giggs had a very poor game until he created two goals.
Yeah, there are a few United players who got a very revisionist press, I think, after the game of how they'd performed, Giggs being chief among them, who actually had a pretty bad game and then did a couple of opportune things at opportune moments.
Right. OK, well, United's next three games after the international break are away to Tottenham Hotspur, at home to Man City, and then away to Stoke. Stoke, who beat Sunderland, of course, this weekend, and are now fifth in the table, challenging for those Champions League positions. You could easily see them coming away without wins in any of those games, couldn't you?
I'm not so sure. The defence is still very good. Teams will still find it very hard to score against them. I just think, right at the top level, like as you saw in the Champions League final, the midfield might not be cute enough and creative enough to win games.
Mm.
But they are dirty enough, because Arsene Wenger has come out and complained about Darren Fletcher's persistent fouling on Saturday. I think Fletcher gave away six free kicks, which is more than twice as much as any other player during the game. So
well, Van Persie also gave away six, but he was booked.
Fletcher did so without being booked.
Right, oh, that's the thing, because I thought it was strange how Arsenal were complaining about anti-football when they actually picked up far more bookings than United.
Are you suggesting that Football Manager might be something of a hypocrite?
Well, no, or possibly that the referee wasn't impartial enough. But what did you make? As a someone who follows Arsenal regularly, Paolo, what did you make of these claims of anti-football?
I think it was all a bit overblown. I mean, I think there was a lot of frustration after that game, and I think possibly some of it came out in the wrong way. I think Arsenal will feel that they should have got a result from that game because they played well enough at Old Trafford to get a result from that game. And I think in the aftermath of some of that, you do sometimes find yourself looking for excuses that perhaps the real problem is closer to home, perhaps right. In the form of Manuel Almunia on that penalty, and also perhaps he should have got ahead of Diaby to claim that cross, and Diaby wouldn't have been in position to head it into his own net. But
Arsenal need a new keeper, is that the theory?
I don't know if you say new keeper. I just think on that day, two simple mistakes that cost a result that very easily should have been there. And and also misfortune at the other end, because if Ben Foster doesn't save that shot from Van Persie, which was a fantastic save, pure reaction, but fantastic save, then I think Arsenal win that game.
But Fabio Capello has obviously taken notice of Almunia's poor performance because he hasn't selected him for the England squad for their next game. Yeah, I mean, Arsene Wenger has form in the field of getting upset because other teams have the audacity to tackle his players, and this seems to be another case of that. What did you make of his sending off?
What indeed. Seem an extraordinary in such an important game at such a crucial moment to spend 5 minutes.
It was absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. But the fourth official obviously wanted to get on TV or something. Wenger kicked a water bottle, for anyone who didn't see, out of frustration because a goal was correctly disallowed for offside. But the fourth official grassed him up to the referee. The referee then had no real option but to send him to the stands. I think Wenger, because the tunnel is down in the corner of Old Trafford, it's not beside the dugout, he sort of went up to the back of the dugout and sat there and was told he couldn't sit there. So then he stood kind of on top of a plinth behind
the
dugout.
Yeah, he was on the plinth on display. I mean, he could have had a really serious incident going on there.
Well, one person did mail me and asked me to point out that while he was up there and throughout the game, Manchester United fans were singing that old song about Arsene Wenger having the sweets in his pocket and his cheeky smile, wondering why journalists never mention this anymore, because it's as bad, or if not worse, as any abuse any other manager or player gets. So I didn't hear it myself, but I presume he's telling the truth. But the point of the Wenger sending off is that technically, in a point of law, it was a correct decision to give him his marching orders. But one problem I have with it is that the League Managers Association chief executive Richard Bevan has now come out and slammed the fourth official, which may, and Wenger is going to get an apology, and this may now lead to managers being able to do what they like in the dugout because fourth officials are going to be too afraid to flag and tell on them to the referee. Steve Staunton famously got sent to the stand for kicking a water bottle.
I always picture Steve Staunton kicking a water bottle. He's very good at it as well, really thrashing it with a great left foot.
Well, right. He was always good with the dead ball.
Yeah, that was the sort of recurring motif of his reign, wasn't it? The booted water bottle.
Perhaps someone should fill a couple of water bottles with cement and leave it to set and then just place it in front of the dugout.
That would be a prank of a wheeze, wouldn't it? Now, elsewhere, Chelsea are on top of the Premier League table with Spurs. Chelsea beating Burnley. Spurs, meanwhile, that's their best start for 49 years, excitingly enough. They've won four on the trot, but Luka Modric is out for 7 weeks. Poor old Luka. Broke his leg.
No, he didn't.
Hold on.
He didn't?
No.
He said he did.
No, he broke a bone in his leg.
What's the difference?
Apparently, there's a very big difference. We were told by a certain football agent yesterday that Luka Modric had not broken his leg, as we were reporting.
Right.
He had, in fact, broken a bone in his leg.
Well, anyway, he's going to be out for 7 weeks. Does that change or not?
I'd imagine 6 to 8 weeks minimum. It's a fractured tibia.
Right, oh, interesting. A perusal of the Guardian's excellent chalkboard facility reveals how much Modric is the fulcrum of everything that Spurs do in the opposition half. As such, it does seem this is going to be a massive blow for them.
But yeah, the timing of it's quite perfect for Harry, because Harry likes the end of transfer windows, and so now he's got a good excuse
to run... He's down to the bare bones already.
Exactly. To run straight to Man City and spend more money. Well, he's going to buy Martin Petrov, apparently.
Is he or Nico Kranjčar?
Kranjčar from Portsmouth, that's true. He's also asset Croatian stripping at Portsmouth.
A massive loss, though, Modric. I mean, he's a wonderful player. He really is.
And to Croatia, of course, who are facing England. Was that this weekend?
Next week at Wembley.
Next week.
Revenge for
oh, it might be.
This is McLaren's revenge. This one's for Steve.
They've been linked with Inter's Mantari as well, just for added kicks.
They will be sending Jermaine Jenas in.
I've heard that
in the opposite direction. Yeah, all interesting theories. Of course, by the end of Monday, you'll know, and I guess we will too. Portsmouth, though, when Barry, when will it all end? When will the ransacking of this once noble club cease?
Well, it will cease, I would imagine, as soon as Nico Kranjčar and David James are signed by Harry Redknapp, because Portsmouth have no other players that anyone would want to buy. I did the minute-by-minute report of their game with Portsmouth yesterday, or with Manchester City yesterday, and I cannot think of any team that has ever put out a worse side in a Premier League game than the one put out by Portsmouth. Mm. I'm talking purely on paper. Mm. They had a few emergency loanees. They had three players that, according to Soccerbase, didn't even have squad numbers yet. Tommy Smith, is that really who you want to bring in to save you when you need a goal scorer? But for all that, they played very well. They were outclassed in the first half, went a goal down, Adebayor header from a corner. That they couldn't really have done much about, to be honest. And then City had a goal disallowed, incorrectly as it happened. And in the second half, Portsmouth came out, gave it a right good rattle, and should have scored an equaliser. David Nugent came on, and about 20 seconds after he came on, he carved a great opportunity for himself, trapping a through ball from Michael Turner, made space for a shot from 6 yards and proceeded to blast it straight at Shea Given when he had two-thirds of the goal to just slot it home into. So Portsmouth were, in turn, lucky they didn't lose by 5 or 6, and also unfortunate that they didn't get a point. But I can't imagine them playing much better, and they still lost. And it's, I'd say they'll struggle to get 15 points this season.
No. This is slightly harsh on Portsmouth, isn't it? I mean, they're not that bad. If you look at the team, it's full of international players and players who other teams have... They're not the worst team ever to play in the Premier League. I think the problem is more the future and the new owner than the actual current playing squad.
But who's going Solomon to score goals for them?
They have strikers. I mean, I've seen worse attacks put out than...
Tommy Smith, David Nugent.
Well, David Nugent costs £6 million. He's played for England
useless.
And scored a goal. But he is useless.
And he scored a goal
plenty
from...
Plenty of useless strikers knocking about the
place. Ball was actually on the line when he scored it, you know.
It's hunger, Barry. That's hunger. I mean, they have
Ataka,
Kanu and Nugent on the bench. I mean, that's not the worst Premier League team that's ever played.
Well, they're not playing if they're on the bench.
They have today to sort it out, because now their takeover has been resolved.
Yeah, they're owned by a man who nobody really knows that much about, but who seems to have quite good PR.
Right.
Has any money actually changed hands? Nobody seems to know.
Right.
He looks much scruffier than he used to as well. I'm worried that he might not be making ends meet.
He's probably sleeping rough.
His clothes look terrible. He's not shaven. I mean, is he solvent even? I'm sure he is.
He looks suspicious.
Maybe he's sniffing solvents.
He looks in a terrible state. He really looks, really quite upset.
No, it's a fair point to make.
He looks suspiciously like that. I can't remember what his name is. There was a...
Mike Ashley.
No. There was a guy who won the lottery a few years ago, who became like a sort of celebrity figure in the tabloids because he was the lotto lout. Who was always in trouble.
He had cart racing in his garden and made his neighbour's life a misery.
Does he not also look like a bit like that News the World undercover...
Fake shake.
He's a fake shake,
Are you suggesting that maybe it is the fake?
Maybe it is. Who knows?
Well, he may be a billionaire.
Well, there you go. So it doesn't seem that this rescue mission is going to necessarily pour oil on the troubled waters down there on the south coast.
Why is it so hard to know if someone's a billionaire? This happened with Sir Alan Stamford in the cricket. Why is it so hard to know if someone's really got billions of pounds or dollars, or if they're just making it up?
I don't know, Paolo.
I don't know. I mean, if someone tells you they're a billionaire and they kind of look quite rich and have a helicopter, you know. tend to go with it.
Right, does he have a helicopter, Suleiman Hanfaye?
Well, Alan Stanford did.
Now all Alan Stanford has is an orange jumpsuit. And Portsmouth, the one thing they do have still is their celebrity fan, John Portsmouth Football Club.
Eastwood.
Mm-hmm. And I find it really annoying if you have to do the minute-by-minute reports on their games, because he just rings his bell constantly, and it's really annoying. What it must be like if your season ticket dictates that you have to sit near him.
Right.
A couple of years ago at Highbury, he got the bell taken off him because I was right next to him in the clock end.
It was too noisy.
I was having it, so that's it. They didn't like the noise of Highbury, so they got rid of it, but... It is very annoying.
Right.
I've been at the Emirates when I've been a couple of Arsenal fans near me complaining about the noise of away fans singing. I was always there, be quiet. Right. Very disturbing.
Right. I'm trying to People read. Eating crisps and stuff.
Yeah. Just sitting very quietly watching the game.
Barry, it looks like you may be £20 further away from being a billionaire yourself with your Everton bet, your ill-advised Everton wager. They're beefing up nicely for the season, aren't they, with who have they bought? And Johnny Heitinga, apparently, that's going through today, the Dutch international defender, and Sylvain Distan, another of those gems raided from the... looted, if you will, from the far cell at Portsmouth.
My idiotic bet this season is that Everton won't finish in the top 10. I should really stop making these bets before the transfer window closes. But, yeah, it looks like they had a lucky enough... win on Sunday. They got a very, very late penalty, which Leighton Baines scored against his old team, Wigan.
So, well, Barry, what have you got against Everton?
I don't have anything against them. Why is pointing out that a team is poor or betting against them?
But they're not
why
poor.
Does that suggest
they're
that...
They're basically not a poor team.
Why does that suggest I have something against them?
Because to say they're a poor team, there is no evidence to suggest they're a poor team.
Well, the first
they're
game
finished
of the season
fifth
they
in the league last
destroyed.
Year.
They lost really 6-1 good... in their opening game of the season. That surely suggests they're a poor team.
What about 6 years of progress under David Moyes, finishing fifth in the league, having good players? I mean, this is not a poor team. It's a really well-run, solid club. But your bet was based on one result, that 6-0 defeat.
No.
Rub his nose in it a bit more, Bunny. I tell you what about Liverpool? Are they a poor team?
Well, they're maybe not as good as they'd like to be.
Their win over Bolton, does that impress anybody?
It showed they're tenacious and they stuck at it.
And Glenn Johnson, Mike65IE, says with 2 goals and 2 assists in 4 games, is Glenn Johnson in fact a bargain at £17 million discuss?
I think Glenn Johnson is a very good attacking fullback, but I mean, if you've seen with England, he still has a bit to learn about defending. But you can learn to defend. I mean, you can, you know, he can improve, and he is improving. It's hard to learn how to attack properly, and I think he's worth persisting with for England.
I think from that game, what you learn is that referees very much favour big four or big six teams in 50-50 decisions or even 60-40 decisions. Teams like Bolton are never going to get the rub of the green. They were very, very unfairly reduced to 10 men, and that cost them the game.
Well, thanks to Lucas Leiva's decision to...
fall over. Yeah. The slightest bit of contact.
Well, it was that, and then the fact that he kind of chased the referee, pointing out the fact that it was time to send Sean Dayes off, which was a little bit... left an unpleasant taste in the mouth. But there you go, eh?
Yeah, but if the situation had been reversed and it was Sean Davis chasing the ref asking for a Liverpool player to be sent off, it wouldn't happen.
There you go, another weekend in the Premier League. Plenty more to discuss here on Football Weekly, including events in Spain where the league has got underway, and Italy, and elsewhere. And we'll continue in just a second. Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello.
Hi, Sid. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Very well. Have you recovered from all the excitement Saturday night at the Bernabeu?
Yeah, I think I just about recovered, yeah. It was a weird one because it was one of those games where you sort of left thinking, all right, what's the conclusion here? And you also left with a very clear thing, which obviously always happens in Spain, of everybody else drawing the conclusions that they kind of want to draw, if
right,
you see what I mean. So the Madrid press are saying Madrid were brilliant. The Barcelona press are saying they were rubbish. And, of course, the Madrid press are also taking great delight in the guy that scored the first goal being Raul.
Right. I should point out, I should have mentioned this before, they were playing, of course, Deportivo La Coruña Saturday night in one of the opening games of the Liga weekend. Which conclusion did you draw then after a night's thinking?
Well, I drew the conclusion that in truth, this is what you expect, isn't it, the first game? There were some very positive signs from Real Madrid. They've got so much talent in the side. There's absolutely no doubt they're going to score loads of goals this year against a lot of teams, and that it will take time for them to be a genuinely good team, but they have wonderful players. You know, a couple of years ago, Fabio Capello asked for 50 days to see the real Madrid when he was here, and 50 days later they got stuffed by Getafe and played absolutely appallingly. This is still the opening day, and everybody's kind of rushing to make conclusions, and I think the jury's out. In fact, I don't think the jury's even kind of seen the evidence yet.
Right. What about the tears of Ronaldo then?
Yeah, this has come from an interview in El País yesterday where he admitted he's a little bit of a tearful type. It's quite a nice interview with Ronaldo, actually. And he makes two or three relatively important points in it and talks about his life in Spain and the pressure on him and so on. And one of the big things he points out is that, you know, people think I'm an extraordinary, but what I am is an ordinary person, which of course is nonsense because all footballers say that and it's just not true. But as he points out, living in an extraordinary situation and one that I think is still taking him a little bit to get used to in Madrid.
Because the pressure is so much more intense?
Yeah, if you look at his celebration of his goal on Saturday night, I thought there was a really kind of a sense of vindication, a sense of yes, I put it away, and relief about the way he celebrated the goal. And it was actually quite endearing because it wasn't posy, his celebration. It was like yes, great, it's out the way, I've done it, I've got it. Much more than you'd sometimes expect to see where he'll stand there and kind of be preening. And I do think that he's feeling a little bit of pressure. He's talked a lot about not feeling the pressure. I'm sure he's lived in England, played for Manchester United. I'm sure he's used to it to some extent. But it does seem to me that this is that little bit more again.
Poor chap. What about Kaká and the rest? Are they managing to deal with this extraordinary difficult situation equally well?
Well, I think that it's not as difficult for them. I mean, because despite everything with Real Madrid, it is all focused on Ronaldo. It is him that's getting followed around. It is him that everybody's obsessed with, and much more so than the case of Kaká. Obviously, Kaká handles things in a very different way anyway. And I think as well, because Ronaldo obviously is the more expensive player, because this was kind of coming for a year and a half, 2 years, because it feels like it's hung on him. Because he's the world's best player and so on, and he's quite clearly determined to continue to be so, even though obviously right now probably Messi is the better player. I do think that he feels that pressure perhaps a bit more than the other players do.
All right, but anyway, so he says he blubs after games that don't go his way, is that right?
Well, that's one of the various things he said, yeah, that he blubs after games. He made a point as well about saying about living with his family and the significance of that, and the fact that they feel like by coming back to Iberia, obviously not Portugal, but by Iberia at least, he feels that he's now kind of almost back at home, and he's bought a house in a part of Madrid called La Finca, which is very, very smart. It's good, kind of, as you can imagine, I suppose, footballers' area of town. But he's bringing his family with him, and they were all there at the game the weekend, and I think that's significant. He's clearly quite an enormous mummy's boy, and I don't necessarily mean that in a disrespectful way. He is clearly very, very close to his mother, and perhaps since his father died, that presumably makes a difference, and they've all moved in with him. So I think this is it's going to be a different experience from here than it was in Manchester.
Are you ghosting his biography, Sid?
No, I'm not. Right.
No, I was just wondering. Okay, Sid, in other non-Cristiano Ronaldo-related news... Oh, Barry, you have a question.
I just wanted to ask Sid who this bearded gentleman Madrid appear to have replaced Iker Casillas with in goal is.
It's quite bizarre, isn't it? Yeah, he's had quite a few people accusing him of trying to look like Jesus Christ. And let's not do the obvious jokes about looking good on crosses.
Right, all right. Let's see, Valencia beat Sevilla 2-0. Atletico Madrid.
Yeah, the big game, Matt, as well. I mean, in so much as, you know, these are the two sides that are most likely or considered most likely, along with Atletico Madrid, to challenge Madrid and Barcelona this year. And Sevilla were, basically, they lost it on a terrible pitch once Freddy Canute had been sent off.
Why was he sent off, Sid?
He was sent off for two bookable offences, one which looked a little bit like an accidental elbow to me that he got yellow for, the other one he was reaching for the ball studs up, and probably both were just about a yellow. But there's something, you know, that sits a little bit uneasily when there's a clash between Carlos Marchena, who's probably the nastiest footballer on the face of the earth, and Freddy Canute, who's one of the nicest, and it's Canute who goes off with a red card.
OK, well, Valencia beat Sevilla there then, and Atletico Madrid, you mentioned, they had a poor start where they got beaten 3-0 at Malaga. Jimmy87 posts in and says, would Sid be able to tell us a bit about Tenerife? Does, asked Jimmy87, an island team like Tenerife struggle to attract players since they are so far from mainland Spain? I think the commentator mentioned that the distance from Zaragoza to Tenerife was the same as London to Kiev. Is it true, Sid?
The distance, I don't know exactly the distance, but it should be roughly that. I mean, bear in mind that the Canary Islands, although they belong to Spain, they are right down the western side of Africa. It is a long, long way. I think the flight from Madrid to the Canary Islands is about 3.5 hours. That tells you, you know, we are talking about a long way away. Tenerife, I thought, were reasonably impressive against Zaragoza on Saturday night, and I watched the whole of that game and was quite impressed with one or two players, but I think Tenerife will struggle. Whether they fail to attract players, I don't really think that's necessarily the case, because bear in mind you're living in the Canary Islands, which isn't a bad place to be, and certainly Mallorca have found over the years that sometimes they've been able to attract players more than mainland Spain clubs would be able to do. And I tell you what, certainly if you had to choose between living in Tenerife or living in Zaragoza, you'd go to Tenerife every time.
Sid, how did Jermaine Pennant get on in his La Liga debut?
Yeah, well, that was that game against Tenerife for Zaragoza, and I thought he played really quite well, in so much as he promised quite a lot. He looked clearly the fastest player on the pitch by a long, long way. Every time he picked up the ball, he really, really ran at Tenerife. They hacked him down a couple of times really, really badly, and really kind of hideously blatant fouls. And the fans took to him a lot. They really liked the fact that he was going at people, that he was determined to try and make things happen. It didn't quite come off for him. He put in a couple of quite good crosses, as say, a couple of good runs, and he went off with about 15 minutes to go and very clearly looked up to the sky and shouted something that rhymes with clucking bell. And because he had a little bit of a pulled muscle and not yet sure of the full extent of that, it looks like it's what's known in Spain just as a sobrecarga, which essentially is just a strain, that there's been a little bit too much strain put on the muscle. So it doesn't look like it's serious. But yeah, it was promising, very promising.
Indeed so. Sid, thank you very much for that, and look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Brilliant. Speak to you then.
Thanks, Sid. Now, in other European news, Hamburg are top of the Bundesliga after a 3-1 home win over Cologne. Hey, Bayern Munich got their first win after sticking Arjen Robben in their side. He scored twice in his debut, only joined them the day before, as Bayern beat Wolfsburg 3-0, taking a lot of pressure off manager Louis van Gaal. In France, Barry, Bordeaux reclaimed top spot in Ligue 1 on goal difference with a 0-0 draw at Marseille. Bordeaux, that ended a run of 14 successive wins for them. They might lose Chamakh by the end of the day. That's what the rumours are saying, isn't it, Paolo Bandini?
That is what this morning's rumour mill would have you to believe.
Right.
How much are they going to bid for him this time? It was 5 million before, wasn't it?
Arsenal, that is, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's very unhappy, isn't he? People are ruining his career and not allowing him to go there.
Yeah, and he hasn't exactly.
Did
how
he tweet
feels.
Saying sort it out?
Well, maybe he should do, yeah.
In French, of course. There you go. Loads of teams tied together. Bordeaux, Paris Saint-Germain, Lyon. Well, three teams, actually. On 10 points. Montpellier, newly promoted Montpellier, and Marseille, a couple of points behind them in Ligue 1. Post, what was exercising the listeners' minds this week? Well, the Eduardo ban, actually. You'll like this. Barney, lots of people talking about the ban that Eduardo picked up retroactively.
Yeah. Well, he hasn't picked it up yet. He won't hear it until
oh, really?
Tomorrow,
I thought they'd
Tuesday.
Announced.
No, but it's very likely that he'll get a two-match ban.
UEFA have announced that they have the power to impose a ban, but they haven't announced whether they will be imposing it or not. We'll find out on Tuesday.
Yes.
But Arsene Wenger has been crying conspiracy, saying that the only reason they're investigating it at all is because of the Scottish influence at UEFA.
Right, the Scottish
in
mafia.
The dormant volcano in which their headquarters.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? There's an interesting clash of historical forces. The Northern European style, Southern European, the rule changes, the emphasis on playing with the ball rather than fouling your opponent. I mean,
are you suggesting that this is all about the fact that the Scots like to foul and have been caught out by rule changes?
Something interesting going on there. I mean,
Here's something interesting, equally interesting. Craig Mann says it points out that it's strange giving him a two-game ban, where if the referee had actually spotted the infringement during the game, he would only have given him a yellow card, which is a completely different set of punishments.
It would be nice if they stamped out diving.
Yes.
And banning players would almost certainly stamp it out. But if they ban Eduardo for two games and then don't ban the next person who does it, it's going to be a
bit... It's consistency, isn't it, really?
Yes.
Did you see Aboué's dive? That was a really good dive.
Mm. And well done for the referee for spotting that. Now,
if you hadn't spotted that
Aidan McGeady also booked for diving, and Tony Mowbray not happy about that.
I thought that was wonderful that you had Tony Mowbray. His actual complaint was based around the fact that, well, they wouldn't have picked up on this if it weren't for the fact that everyone's talking about diving. Because we've picked up such a fuss about Eduardo diving.
It's a measure of how ridiculous football is and football fans and players are, that the exact same Celtic players and fans who were pissing and moaning last week about Eduardo not getting booked for diving are now pissing and moaning about McGeady getting booked for diving less than a week later.
Isn't the whole point about following football that you can be ridiculously subjective?
Oh, absolutely,
about it?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Marty Porn says, what if referees were allowed to invert a penalty decision if they thought the forward had died deliberately to try and win one, i.e. award a penalty to the defending team? I know it might never happen, but it could make forwards think about staying on their feet more. Certainly could, Marty Porn, if only you were sitting there in the corridors of power, or walking in the corridors of power, whatever it is you do in corridors. M. Meister wants to talk.
What do you do in corridors?
Well, anyway, there are lots of things you can do
in corridors of power.
It'd be dangerous.
Health
yeah.
and safety issues.
Yeah. You might lean gently.
You might do.
I
you might stand
you
and chat
you,
to other big
nods. You whisper, don't you? Whisper in the corridors.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Okay. And go from A to B as well.
Mm. A and B being powerful places.
Both. Right, okay. Or one could be the bathroom. On your
well, are they powerful one, places though? If there's nobody in them? If the people who are supposed to be
is
are
a place
only
inherently
on the way
powerful?
There.
I mean, the real power resides in the people in those corridors.
Or does it? If I make a call from UEFA headquarters, is that the same as me making a call from here?
It depends what the call is. If you're just posting a tweet on your now burgeoning Twitter page,
right,
then that's probably not a call from the corridors of power.
Right, no, it wouldn't be. M. Meister says, regarding the Champions League draw, which of course happened after we, you know, and etc. I think at least one English team should make it to the final, says M. Meister, his neck thrust firmly outwards there. My bet is Arsenal. Can anyone outside of the big three leagues, though, asks M. Meister, make a challenge or even win? He suggests potentially Bayern, who we just heard are doing well, and Lyon. What do you think? Stuff of madman's dreams, eh?
No, it's just very unlikely.
Are Lyon the best team in France at the moment? I think there's a debate about that.
Well, they're roaring back. Paul Doyle was explaining how with Lisandro Lopez, they're roaring back in. Into
we
the
have
picture.
This every season in the pod. Paul Doyle says that French teams are great and they're going to do well in the Champions League, and then they don't because they're not great. They're useless.
What about the draw then? A quick comment to that. Chelsea with Apple Nicosia, Atletico Madrid and Porto. Liverpool with Debrecen. Fiorentina and Lyon, aforementioned, and Arsenal in with AZ Alkmaar, Olympiacos, Standard Liège, while Man United will be facing Besiktas, CSKA Moscow and Wolfsburg.
Well, Arsenal got Manchester United's draw by the looks of things because they got just basically they're up against three pub teams. You didn't mention Rangers there.
Sevilla.
Who got quite... They're off to one of the most Catholic cities in the world, but they'll feel at home because there's lots of orange groves in Seville.
Yes. Paolo, you would argue that the Italians got a much tougher deal.
Yeah, I'll just say quick on the Man United thing. I think the worst part of that draw is they've got to go to Moscow, I think, right before they play Liverpool.
Ooh.
So I think that's the about as bad as it gets for English clubs. The Italian teams, I think, had a bit of a roster, really. I mean, they've got Inter are going to be seeing Ibrahimovic again soon because they've got Barcelona in their group, and they've also got both their other two teams are both difficult away trips because they've got...
Rubin Kazan... Champions of Russia, of course, and exactly. Dynamo Kiev.
Yeah, and
with Shevchenko.
Milan is a little bit tricky because I feel like the way Milan are at the moment, I'm not sure if many Italians would be that confident about them playing anyone, but certainly Real Madrid were the toughest team in the second pot on paper. So
the potential for making Ronaldo cry on that occasion not elevated, you would say, after their derby performance last Wednesday. We'll be talking more about that right after this. Now, second weekend of the Italian season has just been completed, and it featured two huge games, one of which was the Milan derby. Barney, you didn't see it. Paolo, what did he miss?
A really impressive showing from Inter. I mean, I sort of think it was an enjoyable game for the first sort of hour or so, and then really it did just peter out because, you know, Inter had basically so completely run away with it by that point. Yeah, I mean, I've been just writing my column for Guardian.co.uk. I'll be on the sport blog later. But, I mean, you know, all the reports was afterwards, a lot of people were saying, oh, God, the game only lasted 15 minutes. And even though there wasn't actually, even Inter didn't even score until the 29th minute, in essence it did, because for about a quarter of an hour, Milan played some not stunning football, but they played reasonable football. They had some movement around the final third. You thought, okay, Pato looks lively, maybe we're going to have a game here. And then what happened was it was like a switch went off for Inter. It was genuinely a stunning transition, especially when you think about how they played at Bari last week.
Right.
Something just clicked and they were just suddenly playing this football, that, you know, beautiful football, basically.
Flipper one football, touch. They call it.
Yeah, flipper football. I mean, it was just one-touch passing all around the field. The first goal from Motta was the work of a little four players involved in a little triangular move on the edge of the box that just threaded him through. And then moments later, Eto's bursting down the right onto a ball from Maicon, and Gattuso gives away a penalty. And pretty much game over at that point after half an hour. But the football was just like nothing I've seen from Inter under Mancini or Mourinho.
Certainly not since Cooper. You'd have to go back even further than that. When was the last time you saw Inter playing that well?
Mid-90s
or something?
I think you are literally looking at going back that far. I think certainly, you can't think of anything this decade.
Actually, you know, under Mancini, they did have one or two games. There was a 3-2 comeback win against Sampdoria when they looked brilliant. But to see them playing that kind of ticky-tacky flip or whatever you want to call it.
I think the thing is that when they were brilliant under Mancini, and that I don't think we want to take away from the fact that they were very good at times under Mancini, certainly domestically. I think when they were brilliant then, it was like, okay, oh, Ibrahimovic has done something brilliant, and then, you know, someone else done something brilliant. Figo maybe has done something brilliant. But this was genuinely the whole team involved in the attacking moves, and I think it was just a style of play and a cohesion that really hasn't been seen very often.
Because Wesley Sneijder had joined? Because he started the game.
Yeah, well, it was a wonderful piece of misdirection by Mourinho, who spent the whole week huffing and puffing and saying, oh, I've seen journalists climbing up trees outside the training ground because they had guards all around the training ground being shown on because he has tactics. And then he said, it doesn't matter because everyone knows what we're going to do anyway. And then, you know, the press were like, well, he's going to use Muntari behind the attack and he's going to pull Stankovic back because they'd obviously clocked this, that Stankovic didn't have such a great game behind the attacker against Bari, and so he was going to pull him back to a deeper role. And then actually, of course, Sneijder signed on Friday, hasn't trained yet, walked straight into the starting 11. And actually, you know, he wasn't the most important player there. The most important players were probably Milito, Motta, Eto, were all excellent. But his presence was, I think, really significant. I think it completely caught Milan off guard, and, you know, he helped knit together that midfield and attack, which has always been the problem for them, hasn't he?
Meanwhile, at Milan, all sorts of problems, as you might imagine, after a 4-0 defeat from your biggest rivals, and particularly after the confusion over Gattuso's sending off. Basically, Gattuso got injured about 15, 16 minutes in, called for a substitution, or at least he tried to play on for a bit. Then about 20 minutes afterwards, when it was clear that he wasn't going to be able to complete the game, he called for the substitution. Leonardo apparently first thought of putting on Ambrosini, then decided to go for Seedorf. But Seedorf was sitting on the bench in a pair of flip-flops and without a jersey on. So it took him a while to find a jersey and get some boots on, by which time Gattuso, in his attempts to keep up with the pace of the game, had picked up a second booking and was sent off and left the field screaming at both Seedorf and Leonardo. Apparently there's a lot of ill feeling now in the locker room, or at least that's the story that's filtering out towards Seedorf, the fact that he was sitting there in a derby with a pair of flip-flops on.
But why was he doing that? Why was he wearing a pair of flip-flops?
Well, because he says that the message that's come out from his side of it is that he didn't think he was coming on till the second half.
Yeah.
And he wasn't wearing a jersey because it was too hot.
The guy I know who played professional football was about to make his debut for Sunderland.
Mm.
And didn't because he had left his jersey in the dressing room. So when he was told to warm up, he didn't have a jersey and he was just told to sit back down again and someone else went on.
Right.
It's just moronic.
The team basing his tactics around who's actually brought the shirt.
famously, that's what happened to Tony Cascarino for Ireland, isn't it? There was a game where he was sitting on the bench and they called him on and he was sitting there and he started unzipping his top and suddenly realised he hadn't got a shirt on underneath his top. He left it in the changing room. And I think just at that moment, Ireland scored and it sort of bailed him out of the situation a little bit. But I think he thought he was about to get punched by the manager.
Huh. But surely every player who's on the bench should be wearing boots, a jersey,
you would think
kitted out.
Well, yeah, and he should have been out warming up since Gattuso picked up his injury. Anyway, as a result, Gattuso got sent off. They were down to 10 men. Seedorf came on anyway. And I think the other big issue, because Leonardo, obviously the rookie manager, has been had the finger pointed at him for this, but also for the fact that when he decided to rearrange the team after going a man down, he took off Borriello, who was, you know, quite young and active, and left Ronaldinho on. Mm. And a really abject performance from Ronaldinho, who's not even smiling anymore.
I do think Leonardo's stuck between a rock and a hard place with Ronaldinho. Because even if this story about Berlusconi and the table in pre-season has, you know, Ronaldinho has now said that was a lie, I think Berlusconi is certainly applying a lot of pressure that Ronaldinho
he's publicly said that he should play. Yeah.
And he wants to play up front as well, which is kind of where he wound up in the game, but he was totally anonymous.
The other thing to mention, of course, before Barry presses the eject button on his escape pod over there, Genoa, they lost Motta and Milito, but they're still brilliantly. They're still top.
Yeah, big win away from home for Genoa this weekend. Atlanta, and it was a good result.
Indeed it was. They're up top with who? Sampdoria.
Sampdoria won again.
And Juventus.
Yeah, Juventus.
Lazio.
Really tidy performance from Juventus against Roma. I mean, Roma are just very unbalanced at the moment. They're good going forward and they're so bad at the back. Mm. But Diego is coming on very nicely, and lovely goal from Melo at the end as well.
Right, a brace from Diego. Amazing to see how quickly, I mean, we were talking about Owen, Robin and Schneider walking into teams, but Diego as well, he picked up that team, become the leader within, you know, the space of a couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's not unlike Schneider, where there was sort of a real hole in that team waiting for a driving force, someone who's really willing to carry the game. A lot of players with talent, but maybe not quite so much legs about them, and he's willing to sort of run, charge up and down the field. And with Melo in there providing the support for him, it's working really nicely.
Now, also on the Italian front, big rumours this weekend that Adrian Mutu was about to play his last game for Fiorentina. This on the basis of the fact that Chelsea's request for that 14.8 million euros, isn't it? Euros, yeah?
Pounds.
14.8 million pounds.
17 million euros.
Yeah. 17 million euros. Had a deadline of this Monday morning. Ergo, if he hadn't paid, then they would then get FIFA to suspend him and he would have to retire as a professional footballer. Now, that hasn't, as far as we know, come to pass. But it does, once again, put this story back in the spotlight, and it is an extraordinary story. Mutu, who was found positive in a private dope test arranged by Chelsea, positive for cocaine, who was then fired by Chelsea rather than encouraged to attend any kind of rehabilitation program, and who as a result is somehow liable for the money that Chelsea think they would have made if they'd been able to sell him on afterwards.
I think it's a terrible treatment of the player. I mean, for a start, Chelsea should have been trying to help him get his life back on track rather than firing him. They should be going after the person who advised them to fire the player rather than getting him back on track and then selling them, not after him himself. And I think he's got a good case to appeal against this as well. I
mean, Barney, you have a legal background, so it's comforting to hear that from you.
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly how comforting that would be.
Right.
But I just think, who's responsible for Chelsea's loss in all this? I mean, it's them. They've fired someone who was actually very valuable to them.
At no point has he made this money from Chelsea, so why should he be liable to pay it back now? I mean, they could go after Juventus for
that. Well, they're saying their loss is that's what they could have got in transfer fees.
Yeah,
but they could have got that if they'd stood by him, helped him to stop taking drugs and then sold him. I mean, he's gone to Fiorentina and scored 47 goals in 77 games since 2006. He's obviously not taken so much cocaine he's destroyed his football career. It was a really weird decision to fire him, and I think they should live by that.
I've heard lots of sort of contrasting things. I know some Chelsea fans I've talked to have been adamant the club sort of offered him rehab and he refused at the time. Now, obviously, since he quit Chelsea, he really has gone and sorted his life out in a really big way.
Well, he did go to the Sporting Chance Clinic.
Yeah, but I think he sort of may have, for whatever reason, there's a perception that he didn't take Chelsea's initial offer of help, and so Chelsea said, fine, if you're not going to take our help, then off you go. But then again, I still feel like, even in that situation, even with that background, I still feel they could have got a value for him. It's not like they could have got zero for him.
Is he really in the best state to make those kind of decisions for himself? Yeah. Firing him because he's not immediately going, I mean, he's obviously got...
Nobody's saying he didn't make mistakes, and possibly he even behaved badly when he exited the club. I have no idea what has led to them taking this very, very, what seems to be a very bitter stance towards him. But I cannot conceive of any act that he might have done which would warrant a £15 million fine. I mean, that's effectively crippling him financially for life. Barney, as our legal man, what can he do? Can he just declare himself bankrupt? Can he go to the European Court of Human Rights?
Well, yeah, he can appeal to a higher court than the Court of Arbitration for Sport.
Right.
And presumably it'd be the European Court.
I hope it was very good cocaine, because it's certainly proving costly.
I think the issue here is that this is one of those areas of unproven law, isn't it? I mean, CAS basically has a remit that doesn't actually relate to the you know, real world, in inverted commas. It relates to sport. It's very specific. Right. And so there hasn't really been much by way of test cases between, you know, if people going to the actual outside legal courts. I know that football frowns upon it a lot, and I know that FIFA would probably, you know, try and stop him from doing it.
But they can't stop him from doing it. If he wants to do that, that's not above the law.
Chelsea refused to comment on this yesterday, but I think it's time they did comment on it, because their apparent determination just to hound this guy out of football or ruin his life needs to be addressed. I'd like to know why they're so determined to do this.
It's the spectre of one of the richest football clubs in the world going after an individual for a mistake that he made several years ago does seem extraordinary. And when you talk about going to a higher court, I mean, the court of public opinion is surely going to be massively against
Chelsea. Well, a lot of Chelsea fans, I've been looking at a blog on a website yesterday, or a comment section on a website, and a lot of Chelsea fans seem to be of the opinion that, well, he did the crime, he broke his contract, so that's tough. But that seems to be a non-compassionate view to take.
Appeal to a higher court, Adrian, it'll all be fine.
Otherwise, we'll all have a big whip round for him. if everyone in Europe just threw in a pound each, you know, we'd more than pay is fine.
Well, there you go. Adrian Mutu, our thoughts are with you here in Near Earth Orbit. But that's about it, I think, though, for today's bulletin. Many thanks to Barney Rone for joining us here.
Thank you.
And to you, Barry Glendinning.
Thanks.
And Paolo Bandini.
Thank you.
And producer Ian today. Excellent stuff. We'll be back on Thursday. Looking forward, and how, to the weekend's internationals. So hopefully you'll be joining us then. For now, bye-bye.